talk is Professor Nikitas Dimopoulos from University of Victoria.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Thanks, Yale, for inviting me. This is a very nice venue and very sentimental venue. Before I start, I would like to basically talk a bit about our friend, Stamatis. I want to talk about Stamatis and his loves, and of course that's his primary love, his family. And there are some other loves Stamatis had. I know Stamatis, I think, the longest from everybody here, almost 40 years. We met way back when we were very young, and we are basically seeking, and we continue to seek. Unfortunately, some of us cannot. Hopefully, the seeking will continue by the students of ours and his. My friend, please rest in peace. May the earth of Samos be light on you. Okay, so I want to talk on some different type of computing. We talk about, we've heard the previous speakers about traditional computing, but we want to talk about computing of a different type, neural computation. Neural computation has many aspects. It can be seen essentially as another model of computing and with primary applications in learning, deep learning. Another aspect that I'm interested in is trying to really understand what's going on between our ears, try to actually pose questions and figure out what nature has come up with solutions. So I want to go very quickly, and I have many slides. Hopefully I'll skip some of them. I'm going to go through some of the physiology and anatomy of the human brain, and then try to pose questions and try to see what computations we need to try to perform virtual experiments and try to understand what's going on between our ears. This is basically where we are, okay? Billions of years of evolution has come up with what we have on the left side, 86 billion neurons, 100 trillion synapses, and the whole thing operates in about 15 watts. And on the right side, that's the current technology, the IBM Power 9, 24 cores, 8 billion transistors. Transistors and neurons are not exactly the same, but gives them some order of magnitude. 14 nanometers, much finer details, two dimensions, the brain is three dimensions, 150 watts or more. Okay, so we have a lot ways to go to try to basically approximate what is happening in the brain. So some questions that we have, why we have structures and why these structures are identical throughout the animal kingdom. We find exactly the same structures in monkeys, in pigeons, in cats, and human beings. Their insignificance, okay? And indeed, as we're going to see, there is significance, okay? Some of these structures are very stable, some of these provide rhythmicity, and we need rhythmicity to regulate our processes, memories, behavior, diurnal behavior, et cetera, et cetera. Now, quite of us are getting quite old. We're losing brain tissue. There are diseases where brain tissue basically has been lost. What happens? okay? Can we basically emulate computationally these processes? Can we figure out anything that happens? How can we model and compute? What actually do we need on the technology side to start understanding what is going on? So we have some answers, okay? So some of the structures, as I said, are indeed stable. Some of these actually produce rhythmicity. But we have more questions than answers, basically the why and the hows. So this is our plan, okay? Basically, I'm going to go very quickly about the basic ideas of neural physiology, and then we're going to talk about specifics and the computational needs, okay? Neurons, everybody has some idea. These are the structures. There's a soma. There are dendrites. Those are the inputs, the hillock where things happen, and the axon where the results propagate, okay? Physiologically, this is how they look, okay? It's very difficult to actually figure out the exact physiological details. There are to figure out exactly one neuron, how it behaves in three dimensions. It takes about 3 months of actual work to actually figure out how these neurons are exactly positioned and their ramifications. So it is quite difficult. This is from the hippocampus to show basically some of the connectivity. We can see the dendrites on the white part and how intensely they connect. So what I want to see here is that we have very rich structure that basically provides connectivity. And I'm going to please remember this because we're going to make some comments later on. Computational models, so what happens with it? It's one of the neurons. The classical Hodgson-Huxley neuron, these are the computations and then simplified integrated fire type models, which are much simpler. I'm not going to go into details. I just want to go through this table, this picture basically to show you the magnitude of the difference of the computation needs. So what we have basically the models, the more accurate ones in here, the case of Hodgson-Huxley, and then the simplified ones at this point. And the magnitude of the computation difference can be seen on the x-axis. It's basically three orders of magnitude more computation in Hodgson-Huxley. So a lot of activity has happened trying to figure out models that are simplified. So we can actually compute much easier. But we have to question that a bit later. So one very, I believe everybody has heard that, is the sigmoidal function. Okay, so this is how it's been computed, and I brought it here because, our friend Stamatis had done some work on it very early. Essentially how we can make that computation very efficient. But now what is that sigmoidal function? How is it related to actual physiology? This is what happens here. If you take the various models and try to figure out how frequently the spikes appear on the axon versus what is the input, how hard we drive them. This is what it looks like, okay? So we can see essentially something that goes down like this. And you can idealize it. So this is what you have. You have essentially thresholds, and you have refractory periods. That means you cannot produce a spike until a certain period has elapsed. And then if you inverse it, you get the famous sigmoidal function at the bottom, okay? And then you have the computation. However, there is a difference. So this is Hodgson-Huxley model, and this is one of the simpler ones. And you can see that although both functions seem similar, there are differences between them. And please remember that, we'll come back to it. So which model are we going to use? Are we going to use the more expensive one or the simpler one? Okay. Most of the research that has happened up to now is using towards the simpler computational model because it's more efficient and we can do our work much faster and of course can get some results. Okay. So now we talked about the neuron. We're going to go up to the system level, to the network level. And as I said, nature is not haphazard, okay? It has structure, okay? So this is basically an idealized view of the brain, and I'm going to focus on two structures. One is the cerebellum here, and the other is the hippocampus, okay? So why? Well, this is hippocampus, so I'm going to go very quickly. These are the two structures. Again, both of them are idealized. They came from anatomical studies done back in the beginning of the century, of the last century, by Ramon y Cajal. And what is interesting is that these structures comprise of certain types of neurons. Some of them are excitatory, okay, so they try to actually propagate the action. Others are inhibitory, try to suppress the activity. And if you abstract them, this is what happens at the bottom. So this is the structure of the cerebellum. This is the structure of the hippocampus on the right. We can see the classes of excitatory neurons in here, the excitatory neuron in here, and we have inhibitory neurons at this point and in here. Okay. So what is the significance of these structures? Well, in the cerebellum, we see that we have essentially no positive feedback, okay? And actually, you can prove it analytically. I have done that, that this is asymptotically stable. That means if you kick it, it will react, and at the end, it will go back to the initial state. And this is very significant because cerebellum actually has been used to control movement, okay? So if it is not stable, I will not be able to move rationally. The other structure here of the hippocampus, well, we can see that we have some positive feedback. So classes, basically the pyramidal cell, the black, the large excitatory cell, self-excites, okay? If it self-excites, then what happens, you might think that you can reach to a state where basically everybody fires all the time, okay? And again, this is not useful because we saturate and that will be very high and nothing will work. That's why you have inhibitory classes that come in and try to regulate, okay? So we can basically see how all these things work. We can simulate what happens. These are some very early simulations that I have them back in the very heroic era. 1140, running for an hour, 2,000 synapses, 60 steps, again, for an hour. But it worked. I could see basically the results are coming out and the system being stable and staying there after the input. Coming back, moving forward, we wanted to do something that is more realistic. So we are doing simulations basically on the hippocampus, again, on the very thin area of the hippocampus, not the whole structure, about 50,000 neurons. And the interesting thing that you want to check here is the number of synapses that you're using, and we're emulating essentially the complete structure of the hippocampus. We have 136 million synapses, so it is the synaptic connectivity is very, very rich. We have run the structure for 10 seconds. 10 seconds of real time. It requires around 20 minutes on a rather recent E5 processor, 12 cores. And we have gotten the results that indeed show that there is rhythmicity. We know that in the hippocampus, we have about a sub 10 hertz frequency, which is called the FIPA rhythm. And lo and behold, this arrives here. And we can see that this structure gives us about 4 hertz. Okay? We're not the first ones. Other people have done that. But what we think is that we have actually have gotten exactly the ethnicity that we want from that structure in the range of the theta rhythm. Now, what is interesting is to see how this structure reacts when we start basically shooting neurons down, okay, when we start having lesions, okay, so well, that's basically a video I'm not going to bore you with it. So we have conducted a couple of experiments where we have many small regions where the lesions exist, and then we have a few rather large regions, and then we grow them and see what happens. And this is the idea. This is the small lesions, and the blue are the dead regions, the yellow are the live, the still live ones. And we simulate it, and lo and behold, we still have seen arrhythmicity, although we have a slight change in the frequency down 4.8 hertz, up 4.9 hertz from 4.0 hertz. Okay? And if you do the experiments, this is what you get. Okay? So this is the percentage of neurons that are dead. Okay? Left and right. The two different experiments. These are small region lesions that we increase the numbers, and the right one is large lesions, which the number of lesions is constant, but we increase the size of them. What is interesting is that the system still exhibits rhythmicity. That means we have a very stable situation. However, subtle changes. First of all, as we increase in both experiments, as we increase the number of dead neurons, we see a slight increase in frequency. Is this a telltale sign of something that perhaps can use medically? Okay, can we see, detect changes in the ethnicity, and that can give us clues that some kind of disease that comes in? It is very early to say, but this is very tantalizing. Okay, so what's the computational cost? As we said, it ran on the latest generation of the Xeon, and it requires about 300 microjoules of energy per synaptic event. Okay, so this is a metric that is being used to characterize what is the cost of the computation. Okay, so what can we do to actually do the computation, do things more efficient? We can do it in software and emulation, but this is not scalable. Okay, so people are coming out with architectures. Okay, so this is the standard one. It's fully dedicated. So we have the neurons, the triangles in here, and we have the synapses on that side, and there is the network that comes back. Basically, that connects every neuron to every other neuron. Okay, but this is not scalable. Okay, it grows basically the square of the number of neurons, and we are talking about millions. This certainly doesn't scale. So, what people have been doing? Well, essentially, we are replacing the old connectivity with a dedicated transmission and reception. Where you receive all the events, you serialize, and you have a dedicated network or a bus that sends them. By the way, the events that go out are spikes, okay, and therefore people are basically recording these events rather than sending the analog expression of them. How we construct these, this can be digital or analog. There is an argument for analog expression, in the sense that you can do computations much more efficiently using analog processes than using digital processes. Okay. However, because of the computerization of the digital processes, analog essentially is lagging behind, and we're going to see some examples of that. Now, to make things even cheaper, we can share the synapses between the same hardware. Now it's kind of multiplexed. Okay. We can share also the dendrites. Okay. So essentially, instead of replicating the computation that goes to each one of the neurons, we just do it once and we send it off. Okay. So these are some of the examples. And there are some projects that are going to quickly review and then talk about, give you some thoughts about what is going to happen. So essentially, we have either hybrid architectures, so we have analog neurons, okay, and then the interconnect is digital. We send the spikes as events, and of course, we have all digital ones. So for the analog architectures, there are some very large projects. NeuroGrid is one. Okay, so the SOMA is a leak integrate and fire, okay, with some extensions. The dendrites and the synapses actually account for some of the membrane capacitance. And then they use essentially the cell dendrite computation where basically all the synapses in a neighborhood get exactly the same the same results. Okay, so this is one way of doing it. They have implemented it, and I'm going to give you details later on. And lo and behold, they have done a very similar structure where we have positive feedback, and they also have seen a similar rhythm arising. Okay. The brain scales is a very similar architecture as the previous one, again, a hybrid. What's interesting about brain scales is that it's a wafer scale integration. That means they have analog neurons on the wafer, and then they do a processing where they do modelization, and they connect them together. So they have demonstrated a system. Caviar is another analog hybrid architecture. This is coming directly from, it's a European project, it's coming directly from the structure of the visual cortex, and they have demonstrated the work in vision. From the digital implementation, the most notable one is the recent one by IBM, the True North. Again, dedicated chips, each one implementing 256 neurons, and 256 square synapses. The neuron core does a simple integrate and fire computation digitally, but it is very, very efficient, and they have shown that they can scale it quite high. What is interesting is that they claim 10 picojoules per synaptic event. And Spinnaker, that's an interesting architecture coming out of Manchester. Again, they have integrated ARM processors. The beauty of it, while in True North, essentially the processors are very specific, so they do only the integrated fire. Of the ARM processors, you can actually program any type of a model that you wish. Again, 18 ARMs, 48 Spinnaker chips, well, 18 ARMs per chip, 48 Spinnaker chips, 864 cores in the whole board. Okay, so this is the interesting thing that I want to show you. These are the comparisons, and what we have here is basically the energies that we need per synaptic event. And this is what nature has provided, 10 heptojoules per synaptic event. This is classic computation. This is what we have done. It's about 300 microjoules, so several orders of magnitude more. Okay. And then we have the remaining This is a classic computation, basically it's an emulation of True North on Sequoia. It's about 1 microjoule, we're at 300 microjoules here, and the difference is that we're using Hodgson and Huxley, and they're using the very simple integrated fire. Why do we prefer Hodgson and Huxley? Well, we have done it with the very simple models. Our hippocampus fracture was providing rhythmicity, but nowhere near the actual feather rhythm. Once you put the Hodgson-Huxley model, then the rhythm came down to the actual feather levels. And then the remaining, basically, they vary between 1 microjoule down to several picojoules in here. The other part that is interesting is the number of connections that we have, okay, and the number of neurons. So there are any variation between several thousands and several neurons, of, millions of neurons, and the number of connections, the synapses, nature actually is very rich in synapses, okay. On the average, from here, you have about 1,000 synapses per neuron. For dedicated structures, you may have more. In the hippocampus, you have about a bit more than 3,000, while everything else here has much less than 1,000 connections per neuron. So all the structures that we have, you have taken 2 minutes. You have taken basically shortcuts to actually come down and have something that is working, but it is not near what nature has provided. And now I would like basically to come to some thoughts. Both analog and digital devices show improvements, okay, in synaptic connectivity, so they have gone down. But we're still 3 orders of magnitude away from biology. And most systems are still far from biologically accurate. Okay, so this is what we have right now. Okay, applications. Well, that's the big question. What do we need them for? Applications. Some of them are basically demonstrations for functionality, and the main applications are vision. Caviar and True North, and demonstrations of deep learning True North and brain scales. Another question is, which ones do you prefer, the analog or the digital? If you look at the performance and the energy from the energy level, the analog seems to be better, but still not that much better than digital. And for the near future, do we need to go that deep? Do we need to go to 86 billion neurons, okay? For which we need the femtojoule per synapse energy. Can we target perhaps applications where we need several orders of magnitude less neurons and less synapses, okay? And if we do this, do we need different architectures, okay? What about detailed system simulations? Again, we got to go to full brain simulation. Probably it's not achievable right now, but can we target some parts of the brain and gradually learn how they work? And what do we need to actually do this? First of all, we need accurate data, accurate models of the neuron, and how do we actually incorporate everything that we have seen. The address event recording, that means setting events rather than the actual spikes down the action, seems to be working. But we're still missing time, okay? We cannot account very easily about delays. And how can we actually do architecture, perhaps can we incorporate reconfigurability and approximate computing to make our digital digital architecture much more efficient. And thanks, Gail. I'm sorry I'm out of time.